First, we will hear from Rebecca Fry, who will give us an overview of the health effects of arsenic. Dr. Rebecca Fry is an associate professor in the Department of Environmental Sciences and Engineering at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill. She also holds appointments in the curriculum in toxicology and the Lineberg Cancer Center. Dr. Fry is the director of UNC's Superfund Research Program and also serves as the director of the graduate studies in the curriculum of toxicology at UNC. She received her PhD in biology with a postdoctoral training at MIT in toxoeconomics and environmental health. Broadly, her research focuses on elucidating biological mechanisms that can relate to prenatal toxicant exposure to detrimental health outcomes in children. Building off her expertise in the areas of DNA repair, toxicogenomics, and systems biology, her research at UNC has identified epigenetic mechanisms that may underlie children's health. A primary goal of Dr. Fry's research is to increase awareness of the deleterious impacts of exposure during the prenatal period and to improve public health initiatives to address this critical issue. Rebecca, I'll turn this over to you now.
Great. Thank you. So thanks very much for the invitation to present. I will be providing some background on general health effects of inorganic arsenic exposure. But first, if we look at this map, you can see that it's highlighted areas around the globe that are contaminated by inorganic arsenic. This map really highlights that almost every continent is affected by potential high-level exposure to arsenic. Current estimates are that more than 100 million individuals are exposed at levels that exceed the EPA and World Health Organization limit of 10 parts per billion. One of the worst hit areas is, of course, this area here that I've highlighted in red, West Bengal and Bangladesh. And I've highlighted a science article from 2007 that's entitled A Sluggish Response to Humanity's Biggest Mass Poisoning. But there are other areas we'll be talking about today in this session. The United States is not immune, certainly, to contamination with inorganic arsenic. We'll talk about the health effects, potential sources of exposure. So in terms of known health effects of inorganic arsenic exposure, arsenic is classified as a group 1 carcinogen, which means it's a carcinogen in humans established to result in cancers of the skin, bladder, lung, liver, prostate, and kidney. There's also increasing information about health effects that are non-cancerous. Those include neurological disorders, reproductive effects, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. In terms of health effects in children, we also know that prenatal and early life exposure is associated with harm to the infant. They can be born at lower birth weight, can be born preterm. Children can have neurocognitive effects, increased susceptibility to disease, as well as birth defects. Some of the striking data that comes out of research from the NCI and the NIEHS was published by Mike Walkies more than a decade ago now, that showed that prenatal exposure to inorganic arsenic was associated with later life disease. So it's really pointing to not only the harm that arsenic can do, but vulnerable time frames for exposure. And these data that come from Alan Smith's group at Berkeley also support in a human population that early life exposure is associated with later life disease, and also highlights both the cancer and non-cancer endpoints in terms of detrimental health effects. And so both of these taken together really point to developmental reprogramming that can happen as a result of arsenic exposure. And our Superfund group, as well as other Superfund groups around the country, have some shared interest in trying to understand biological mechanisms that can underlie this. And so highlighting some potential epigenetic mechanisms that may influence this. And that's important that we think about the health effects and the timing of exposure, also populations who are at extreme risk in terms of health effects. So in the context of today's talks, we know that there are more than 40 million individuals in the U.S. who rely on private water wells for drinking. These are not regulated by the EPA. The Safe Drinking Water Act does not include enforcement of domestic well water quality. In fact, many states or towns don't require sampling after installation of private wells, and it becomes the responsibility of the homeowner to maintain the safety of their water. So the concerns and some of the data also support that individuals who are on domestic wells have increased lifetime risk of bladder and lung cancer that's higher than public well users, so really establishing links between being on private wells that are contaminated and health effects. So you'll be hearing later from our group at UNC. So I just wanted to talk a tiny bit about what's happening in North Carolina. So I wanted to highlight North Carolina geology here. Along the central part of the state, which is highlighted here in gray, there's an area known as the Carolina Slate Belt, and this will become important as I talk about why we have arsenic occurring, which is natural. So we have natural geologic deposits of this, and importantly, we have a very large number of individuals in North Carolina, more than 2 million residents on private wells. So a few years ago, we at UNC Superfund Research Program performed a collaborative study with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services to map arsenic contamination across the state. And our goals were really to work with the DHHS to identify populations at risk, and then you'll hear later from our group about the communities who we're now working with that build upon this partnership, and really to help the agency in thinking through public health action strategies to reduce exposure. Just to acknowledge, this was very strong collaboration that involved numerous people, including Kathleen Gray, the leader of our research translation core. One of the first steps of this project was actually computational and geocoding, and so the students and the team who worked on this spent many hours geocoding. The impact of that was to increase the knowledge base that we had from less than 3,000 data points to more than 40,000. And so we ended up having more than 63,000 wells that we could look at for spatial and temporal analysis. And what resulted is this, that we could map the areas across the different counties of North Carolina. Dark gray and black are the areas of greatest concern. And so you can notice that the area that I had pointed out before, the Carolina Slate Belt, is the one where arsenic is very high. We found almost 1,500 wells that exceeded the EPA limit, 200 that exceeded 50 parts per billion, and the maximum of 800. So very, very high levels that really highlight some potential concern. We also know that arsenic can co-occur with other contaminants, and so recently we have examined the private well data for patterns of other metals, and so I'm showing you here arsenic, cadmium, manganese, and lead. And if you look at the arsenic and manganese maps on the left, you actually see that the dark areas are similar, and we found that that's statistically significant, that arsenic and manganese do co-occur in North Carolina. And this was a partnership with the North Carolina Birth Defects Monitoring Program, where we showed that there was increased prevalence of birth defects in counties where toxic metals are high. And so again, pointing to the potential for health effects, and in this case, especially in infants in North Carolina. So we have to be thinking about vulnerable populations and how we communicate this information. So thinking about public health considerations, many people may not be aware of the harms of exposure to toxic metals, and so increasing that information. Many people may not be aware of how, or the cost may be too high for water testing. One of our initiatives has also included thinking about biomonitoring that's happening for vulnerable populations, and so that's an example that I described here. So just to summarize, we know that arsenic continues to impact the health of adults and children around the world, and we'll, from the UNC's Superfund, we'll highlight the work that we're doing in North Carolina. We need to increase awareness of communities of sources of exposure and ways to prevent that exposure. And then again, in terms of public health strategies, thinking about ways to increase screening, information for screening, decreasing costs for screening, and implementing biomonitoring so that we can absolutely protect the vulnerable populations. So thank you very much for listening in. Thank you very much to the UNC Superfund program pictured here and my lab there at the bottom. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Rebecca. Do we have any questions? You can submit your questions by using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right corner. And I haven't seen any come on our pod, so I was going to ask if there are any questions on the phone. And you can press #6 to unmute your line, and then you can remute it after you've asked your question by pressing *6. All right, I've got a few questions from on the Q&A. So, Rebecca, is there any speciation of arsenic during the study? Was there any speciation of arsenic during the study?
Arsenic was not speciated in the water samples. In all of our human population-based studies that we do speciate. Yeah, so that's an important consideration as well.
Okay. Burpee asked, could you explain a bit about what is the biomonitoring?
Sure. So biomonitoring would be collecting samples from humans, and an excellent way that we can examine whether someone's been exposed to inorganic arsenic would be to collect a urine sample from that individual. And then we can see in their urine whether or not they have elevated levels of inorganic arsenic, or as the prior question alluded to, inorganic arsenic can be metabolized by humans into different metabolites, and so you can also measure that in someone's urine. And so lots of human population studies do that as a direct measure of individual exposure of a human.
Thank you. Andrew Murray asked, do you have an idea of the percentage of people in North Carolina relying on drinking water wells?
It's about 30%.
And I'm having a problem reading the entire questions. I'm just getting a short list, so I had to skip Mr. Rose's question. I can't see the whole, let's see.
If you click on the question, you can see the whole question. I think her question was cut off. So
yeah, it looks like it was cut off, so I was wondering what that one. But, okay, so I'm going to move on. Rebecca, is the arsenic related with iron in addition to the manganese?
We did not see an association with iron in the multi-metals analysis, yeah.
Okay, thank you. And what portion of the total arsenic is inorganic arsenic in the groundwater in general, do you know?
The majority.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you review the relationship to the Carolina State Belt geology and the occurrence of arsenic
Yes.
Is it really high?
Yes.
And if you want to show the map again, that would help.
Oh, show the map?
Yeah.
So this area, I don't know, can they see my mouse? The area in the central part of the map that is dark, there you go, dark gray and black, that area where the counties have elevated levels, so that the coloring indicates that we are, the dark colors show high levels of arsenic. And if you look back at the geologic picture that I showed of North Carolina, that corresponds with the gray to the right of the dark brown, the Carolina Slate Belt. And so that is an area that, because of the geology, arsenic is high and present because of these natural geologic deposits of arsenic. And this is also many states in the United States have similar issues, and something that obviously we need to be thinking about for individuals who are on private wells, because of the geology, arsenic can be higher in these regions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Karen Butts asked, what is the source of the data for the arsenic mapping project you did with the Public Health Service?
Yes. So the wells were measured at, so it was well testing that happened at the DHHS. So private well in homeowners send their water samples to be tested at the Department of Health and Human Services, and those data are publicly available.
Thank you. Paul Suska, I believe, asked, you had a bar graph showing various adverse health outcomes. Was that showing the strength of the correlation or the magnitude of the health risk associated with the exposure?
Yeah. So these are on the x-axis where it says SMR. Those are standardized mortality ratios. And so you can see that for bladder cancer, which is at the highest point of the cancer mortality. So if this green arrow goes up to the top bar there on the black, the bladder cancer, the standardized mortality ratio is 18.1. So a simplified way for me to describe that is, if you're exposed to inorganic arsenic early in life versus someone who's not, your likelihood of dying from bladder cancer is 18.1 times higher than someone who doesn't experience that. These data come from a population in Antofagasta, Chile, and the arsenic levels there were very high, so I will point that out.
Okay. The arsenic detection and the rate is increasing in Iowa. Is this situation true in North Carolina? Is there any specific filtration system for arsenic in the North Carolina public water system?
So in public water supply, arsenic is monitored and levels cannot exceed the drinking water standard of 10 parts per billion. In private wells, because they do not fall under the Safe Drinking Water Act and they're not regulated, it becomes the homeowner's responsibility to test and then potentially treat. And in terms of treatments, the successful ones are called reverse osmotic filters. And so, yes, there are absolutely ways that individuals can remove inorganic arsenic from their private wells.
Did they check the wells, if the wells are screened open, and correlate this with the soil type or geology to the arsenic levels?
We didn't do that, but I know that there's some continued activity to try to identify at the state level whether there are trends in well depth and well construction, and that would be really useful information as well. So, yeah, it's a really good question.
Okay. Do you know if drinking water is the only concern versus well water, or bathing, showering, inhalation a concern?
To a much less extent, really, the data that I'm showing you here come from ingestion of contaminated water. But, of course, there continues to be increasing information about potential contamination in any foods that might absorb inorganic arsenic. And so some of the research that comes out of Dartmouth Superfund research program has really highlighted concerns for inorganic arsenic in certain types of rice.
Okay. Well, there's an additional question about the impact of skin contact. Do you know if there's any studies on that?
The data really don't support that dermal exposure is strongly correlated with these health endpoints. So the strongest correlation comes from oral ingestion of contaminated water.
Okay. Of the wells tested, what was the approximate percentage containing arsenic above the MCL?
Probably less than 10%. I don't remember that number exactly, but that study is online and publicly available, and that number would be in there. Yeah.
What does the SMR mean on the disease incident chart?
Standardized mortality ratio.
Okay. Well, I think we have done as many of the questions as we can before we move on to our next presentation. We had a little extra time because I was quick on the introduction. Now we're going to switch over to hear from Dr. Yang Zhang from the University of Columbia SRP Center. And Dr. Zhang is a geochemist by profession and a water and sanitation specialist by vocation. She began her career in 1988 with the Research Center for Eco-Environmental Services, Chinese Academy of Sciences, as an environmental chemist after graduating with a BS degree in geochemistry with honors from the University of Science and Technology of China. She has an MA degree in geological sciences, an MPAIL, and a PhD degree in earth and environmental sciences from Columbia University. Since 1998, she has held faculty appointments at the City University of New York and research positions at Columbia University. She is also the director of the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences, Queens College, City University of New York, between 2007 and 2009. With her collaborators and students, she has published more than 100 peer-reviewed articles in chemical oceanography, hydrogeochemistry, and public health, with many discussing arsenic, hydrogeochemistry, and health effects in Bangladesh, China, and the USA. Jan, I will turn this over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, first of all, for the invitation to share our findings with this larger community. And thank you, Rebecca, for a nice overview pointing out the tremendous effect of early life exposure to arsenic from drinking water and the biological vulnerable population. Because private well water quality is not subject to the same monitoring requirement as public water supply by US EPA, so we actually have very little knowledge nationwide as to how good or how bad private well water quality is. So in this presentation, I'd like to make the case for universal screening of private water. And I will use evidence primarily built from arsenic, gained from household surveys conducted in Maine and New Jersey communities. And I'd also like to thank a long list of colleagues listed here. You will see the names, and government partners from Maine and New Jersey, as well as USGS. Much what I'll be talking about today is summarized as a manuscript in review to EHT. Hopefully that'll appear shortly if I'm successful. So this presentation really has two parts. The first part, I'm going to dwell on prevalence rate a little bit, especially arsenic. The second part is to give you a list of reasons why universal screening is absolutely necessary, because if it's not a requirement, many people simply will not voluntarily test. Let's see if I can advance the slide. Okay, so to draw analogy of screening, as Rebecca has mentioned, public health community use a lot of biomonitoring, and this lead screening, blood screening, is very well known. And what I like to point out here is that prevalence rate is a very important factor. Even though each lead testing may cost $25 to $75, even in high prevalence populations, to identify a case, a child who is exposed, pretty much $490 is necessary. So this is a factor that we need to consider, as maybe it'll become more clear later on. Okay, in terms of vulnerable population, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recognized this, that there are risks associated with potable water, and they issued a policy statement recommending annual testing. However, in our surveys in both Maine and New Jersey, very few, if any, households report their testing is prompt by their pediatrician, so there's clearly some gaps. The next few slides, I'm going to dwell on the prevalence rate of arsenic. There's some questions about that, and this is to also recognize United States Geological Survey for their work, starting with this paper in early 2000. As you can see, a smallish data set of domestic well identify a prevalence rate of arsenic of 60.8%. And there are other contaminants of concern, but arsenic is the most prevalent of all. And the map shows you also the private well population is uneven throughout the country. Next is a much bigger data set with potable water, and the map shows you now where the arsenic high arsenic clusters are, Western United States, Northeastern, and around the Great Lakes region. As you also know, there are a lot of data gaps. But once again, the prevalence rate is about 8%. Lastly, Focasio et al., who is the lead author of the previous report, published a paper in 2006. And in this, this specific look at private well water only. Bear in mind, these samples are not evenly distributed, but nevertheless, arsenic shows up as the most prevalent chemical of concern. Nitrate, which is strongly associated with agriculture, rises up too. But you will note here, I want to point out that not only there's MCL exceedance for arsenic, there's also detection. And bear in mind, EPA's maximum contaminant goal, not the level, is set at zero for arsenic. So actually, about half the well water anywhere in this data set have detectable arsenic in it. So at the state level, the communities that we work in Maine and New Jersey, you will see that we actually worked with Maine Department of Health and New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection using very large data sets. But here the data are reported by equal area grid. Each little area is 2 by 2 mile. There are lots of reasons that I won't have time to go into, because this is a better way, statistically speaking, to characterize the spatial variability of arsenic and deal with some of the sampling biases issues. So in 17 towns, happen to be both in the case of Maine and New Jersey, you will see a huge variation of arsenic prevalence rate at a very local scale. And this is highly relevant because in most of the areas in the town, the household that will have arsenic level will be a minority of the household. Therefore, establishing social norm for testing has proven to be difficult. So the prevalence rate is also highly relevant because in addition to New Jersey, this is data from New Jersey, there's a strong correlation between median arsenic level and also the prevalence rate. So essentially, in areas where you have higher proportion of wells exceeding the MCL, in the case of New Jersey is 5, you'll have higher median arsenic levels. So the dose goes with the prevalence. And we have seen this in other areas as well. So to summarize, even though we don't have perfect sampling, as a geochemist and most of us in our community would agree, arsenic is most likely to occur in our nation's groundwater at a prevalence rate about 10%. However, in a given community, there's a great deal of variability at a very small spatial scale. This creates some interesting opportunities and challenges. And the ongoing USGS assessment is essentially overlaying that private well water population spatial pattern with the arsenic level spatial pattern to try to get estimate of the exposed population. It's probably a few million. All right, so the second part of my presentation is to provide a list of reasons based on our research why we propose universal testing requirement. This is simply like a lot of public health measures. For example, seatbelts, helmets, if you don't require people to do it, some people simply just won't do it. And the evidence are as follows. These statements are actually based on a lot of research. So for example, our study and others have found voluntary testing rates in a lot of communities once they reach 50%. It's about 50% right now or less. We also find many reasons, socioeconomic, behavioral, or psychological, or situational factors, why voluntary testing rates will never reach 100%. And increasing that last half of the population, trying to get that is going to be a lot harder than the low-hanging fruits. And additionally, our research finds local testing requirements, specifically the New Jersey Private Well Testing Act, works very well. And everything said, testing is really just finding the problem. We still have the issue of actual exposure reduction, that is getting people to treat for their arsenic and to monitor the exposure. So I want to make the last point first. So in the previous round of SRP funding, I was a project PI looking at the hydrogeochemistry of arsenic occurrence in central Maine. And as you can see, the graduate student Chang Yang surveyed 1,400 households, and this is the arsenic distribution. And we naively assumed, since we tested their well water, then people know the results, they should be correcting, right? So that's not the case. We followed up with this survey, and we found that only actually 70 households act on the testing results. A little bit of good news is that the people with a high dose, as you can see here, actually are doing the best in terms of correct action, and people with the lowest dose tend to not to pay too much attention. So this makes sense in terms of health protection. This picture is our advisory, community advisory board. So summarizing that, in any given community, let's say with 1,000 private wells, at the current testing rate of 50%, you will have the largest proportion of households exposed to arsenic because they never tested and therefore unaware. And for those who have tested, and there are about 70% of them that are treating, but there are 30% who choose to do nothing, and therefore they are still exposed. And in the previous study, we also looked into treatment efficacy. We found about 10% actually higher in some cases are failing, and therefore, so you could be testing and treating and still be exposed. So at a testing rate of 50%, 69% of at-risk households remain exposed. So considering four different scenarios for that exposure, that's why going back to this prevalence rate, this is why it's really important to know what arsenic prevalence rate you're dealing with in your community, because at high prevalence rate, you certainly can, through volunteer and testing, get a lot of people's exposure down by counting on people doing the right things. But we show that even if you reach 100% testing rate, there's still 37% of all at-risk households will choose not to act or their treatment failing and therefore remain exposed. So what do you do? Well, before we get to the testing requirement, let me try to explain why volunteering testing rate would never be 100%. This has a lot to do with human psychology because we are optimistic biased. Our study finds that in terms of arsenic, in New Jersey, previous studies of home radon testing finds that a lot of other health protective behaviors finds that essentially bad stuff happened to other people, not me. And as you can see, I want to point it out in our survey of over 1,000 households in New Jersey, which 600 plus responded, a lot of people, even though are treating, they are not really testing their treated water. And also I wanted to point out there are people who thought about testing but then decided it's not needed. And these are the people who responded to our survey. They're half the population who didn't bother to respond to our survey. So it's unlikely any voluntary testing will get to them. Reason number two is there's very strong socioeconomic vulnerability. What's shown here in both Maine and New Jersey, presumably, if households have all tested, we would find the mean prevalence rate of arsenic in these communities. So that's the benchmark here. But as you can see, only the people in Maine with bachelor's degree are approaching that. People with no bachelor's degree is only half. And also the treatment rate once they find arsenic is also drastically different. And in New Jersey, this is the pre-testing requirement households. Even with bachelor's degree, they're still far below the 22% benchmark. And we find similar trends with income and with certain increasing household income, higher probability of having tested for arsenic. So there is an environmental justice issue here. Reason number three, we did an experiment in New Jersey where we offer free and convenient testing, essentially sending household prepackaged test bottles and instructions to sample, prepaid FedEx boxes. All they have to do is put water in and drop off FedEx and get a free test. And we only got 47% testing rate. And what's really most striking were that the people who took advantage of the free testing are people who are wealthier and better educated. They have eightfold higher odds ratio than a low-income household to take up on the free testing offer. So free testing will help, but helping not the socioeconomically vulnerable. So then what's the solution? So fortunately, New Jersey has the Private Water Testing Act, and you can see what's encouragingly in post-PWTA households, because they are required to test, they actually identify the well water arsenic problem very close to the benchmark. Unfortunately, the pre-PWTA, only 1 in 5 problems are identified. I also want to comment on these two gray bars. People tend not to remember their testing results, and we think that these is probably people who tested fine, they just didn't remember them. For people who actually found problem probably remembered them, but that's yet to be determined. So, so just to summarize, we believe that then testing requirements such as the New Jersey Water Testing Act is really the way to go to get people to test. And this is because once a test is completed, you can identify the people actually have problem, which are a minority of any given community, and then redirect the community engagement efforts to help them reduce exposure, which is very technically challenging. In New Jersey and in Maine, we found reverse osmosis actually doesn't work very well. So is the same in Arizona. This has a lot to do because of the arsenic tree cannot be removed by RO, and iron oxide-based media works better. But in any case, people who have arsenic problem, this is from the main follow-up study, and you can see even when you have the test results, we still have work to do to convince people or help people who are socioeconomically vulnerable to lower exposure. So what's the status of local government testing requirements? Because of the spatial pattern, so perhaps the overall federal level regulation will be an overkill and difficult to implement. At this time, we're proposing for more local government testing requirements in areas of concern for arsenic and hopefully other water quality parameters of concern in a specific community. So this is advocacy for policy intervention. And only 5 states currently have arsenic, but some local communities do have more stringent ordinances. Okay, so I'm going to end here and answer any questions you might have. And I'd like to say that I'm going to start a privatewells.org very soon. So like-minded people, if you'd like to help, please contact me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just want to remind everybody, if we didn't get to your questions, we will send those to the presenter that they were asked of, and they can get back to you with those. I know we've had a lot of questions on the line. Our first question is, how much do the finances influence their ability to follow up when they find arsenic in the water? Do you know, or do you have an idea?
It is a big factor.
Yeah, and kind of a follow-up to that, what is the resources, funding available to those who might have found high levels in their household water?
Some states have subsidies for low-income household for treatment, but I don't think it ever covers the full cost. Even a point-of-use treatment may cost close to $1,000. Whole house treatment are several thousand to 10,000 as high as. So it's definitely, we identify that as a treatment too expensive, definitely as a reason why people did not act on arsenic test results.
Right. And another question as a possible issue is, in states where well water testing for arsenic is required, are the homeowners required to disclose any exceedances in the arsenic in the well water to potential home buyers, similar to radon exceedance, which I think is, you know, might address that, you know, why some people may not want to respond.
Yes, this is definitely some people in Maine, particularly in our survey, responded more so than I don't want to know my water quality. I don't think there is a, I think there's a requirement to disclose anything you know during realistic transactions, but I'm not 100% sure on that. In New Jersey, the testing law does require people, that's a piece of paper you needed to have during real estate transactions, including renting.
Do some of your research methods come from infectious disease, epi, and social science? Could you comment on the challenges of applying those methods to environmental health research?
I didn't dwell on that, but the we actually based our surveys, a huge section of that, based on health behavior theory. So that's fairly prominently used in water and sanitation problems in developing countries. Specifically, we built our survey based on Mazur et al.'s RANAS model, what he called risk, norm, ability, self-regulation, and self-efficacy attitude, and all of that.
Are there communities that are high and are a high risk for arsenic due to local geologies? In other words, could we prioritize testing in the regions that are most likely to have arsenic-rich bedrock or superficial material?
Yes, definitely. I think that would be a wonderful approach, and that's why I think I'm aware my colleague Joseph Ayot of USGS is working with CDC to develop specifically sort of like predictive models for geology and arsenic. We have done so for Maine. But I think EPA seems like the approach is more of spread it around the country. So I think that's a point that's really good and probably worth some discussions of people who want to really encourage more private well water testing screening, because there's a cost-effectiveness issue in here. How much money do you want to spend to find the problematic well?
And what technology, you already explained that it's quite expensive. Do you know what technology is used for the home treatment, and does the system assume has to be maintained?
Yes, this is, I didn't go into that, and that's a great issue of concern because the treatment industry is typically, small business owners. They have their own profession, so there's a wide range of capacity in that industry. The most important thing is the treated water may or may not be tested depending on different places you are. So the regulation is, again, not even. So homeowners pretty much on their own to deal with this very complicated issue that involves toxic substances, essentially, in their home.
What is an example of the iron-based treatment, and why is it better than the RO?
Well, I highly recommend you to look up one of our colleagues, New Jersey DEP, Steve Spades. He has a little cheat sheet about what kind of treatment system works well on New Jersey DEP's website, and that has all the explanations. But basically, iron media absorbs both arsenic-3 and arsenic-5 and some other organoarsenic species. But RO is really excluding ions, and arsenic-3 at neutral pH is not charged in water and therefore will not be removed effectively by RO.
Okay. And can you please discuss the New Jersey PWTA a little more and the major outcomes to date?
The major outcome to date, let me just try to find that figure, is that pretty much everyone's required to test has tested. That's a very good outcome. And once they tested, as you can see the red bar here, most of them, the blue bar, are treating for arsenic. So the testing has resulted in the vast majority of the people treating. However, a lot of the issue with the treating, because the treatment units may be put in by the seller, when the buyer moves in, they may not maintain that, because monitoring treated water for arsenic is still a very minority of people do it. People who are really nuts about their water take care of themselves. And also, people tend not to remember stuff about when it's the buyer who did it. It was just one of the things they got when they bought the house. So we really wanted to look into this more because currently we're so caught up in trying to get people to test, we forget after people find arsenic, they're again left on their own to solve the problem.
Well, thank you very much. That's going to be the last question we'll have time for. I said we'll be forwarded on to you. And now we're going to move on to Dr. Mark Borsuk's presentation. Mark is currently at the Thayer School of Engineering at Dartmouth, but will be relocating to Duke this fall. His research broadly concerns the use of scientific information in complex decision situations. More specifically, his research group develops methods and models that seek to integrate knowledge, data, and stakeholder preferences to both personal and public policy decisions regarding the environment and human health. Thank you.
Great. Mark? Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining in today. I'll try to emphasize the aspects of my talk that complement rather than repeat the other talks that we've already heard. In particular, I'm going to be telling you about a survey that we've done in New Hampshire to assess rates of well water testing of arsenic. But I'll put the emphasis today on what we did as a result of those survey results, in particular the interventions that we implemented to try to get people testing their water. I think there's a lot of overlap with the previous speakers in terms of the content and background, so I won't spend too much time on that. I'll focus on the unique aspects of our study. Okay, let's see. I'm not able to click through. Is that is there a particular button? Oh, here.
Yep, you should have there, right. Yep, you just did it.
Got it, sorry. Okay, so the overview of our project, our aims were to design and implement a statewide survey, as I said. And then using those survey results to identify what important barriers there may exist to water testing and treatment. And then to use that information to design, implement, and evaluate interventions to overcome those identified barriers. And then finally, to use all that, what we've learned, to create a toolkit so communities can then carry on interventions of their own. So a little bit of background. You've already heard about the health effects of arsenic and the fact that it naturally occurs in certain types of groundwater. In New Hampshire, you can see from this plot that higher arsenic concentrations and a greater likelihood of arsenic in water occur at the southeastern portion of New Hampshire. That's associated with the geologic formations in that region. You can see, depending upon the exact spots, this happens to be aggregated by town. It can be as high, the probability of high arsenic that is above the MCL can be over 50%. And this is a particular concern in New Hampshire, where almost half of the residents rely on private wells in their homes. And as you heard earlier, only the homeowners are responsible for testing those. There's no responsibility of the state or towns to test private wells. So I'm going to tell you next about our statewide survey. It began with some focus groups to understand what kinds of questions we should be asking and how those should be worded to get the best information. And then I'll tell you about the content of the survey and the results. We started by doing focus groups in four towns in this mostly in the southern or southeastern portion of the state. You see them marked on the map here, with an emphasis on areas that have high numbers of wells and high possibilities of arsenic in the water. What we found through discussions with the participants in these focus groups were that most people thought, when they thought about well water quality, thought about aesthetic aspects like taste, smell, and appearance. If it didn't look bad or taste or smell bad, they didn't see that there would be any problem with it. And that's a concern for contaminants like arsenic that you can't taste, smell, or see. As was mentioned before, most participants in our focus groups recalled last testing their water in the process of a real estate transaction. And they weren't testing largely because of issues of cost or inconvenience or simply lack of awareness. And those who had treatment systems hadn't tested their water after installing the treatment systems. And that was interesting. That's not something we had thought much about before, but that we learned from the focus groups. And in terms of treatment, like we heard from the previous speaker, cost was the major deterrent. We went on to use this information to construct a survey, which we implemented online in SurveyMonkey. We invited people to participate in the survey through postcards that were sent out to randomly selected addresses in a way that emphasized towns with higher arsenic concentrations. And it was sent only to addresses that were recorded as having private wells. The survey had between 31 and 40 questions, depending upon how people answered some questions. They were directed towards different portions of the survey that were appropriate for them. We got about 700 responses, which represents about less than 10% of the postcards that were sent out. So I was surprised and happy to hear about the higher rates of response that they had gotten in other parts of the country, in Maine or New Jersey. Maybe including a $2 incentive with those could have been influential. We, as you see from our postcard, we mentioned people would win an iPad as part of a random selection if they answered our survey. Maybe that wasn't a sufficiently strong incentive for people. The demographics of our respondents broadly match those of the state. Most lived in a single-family residence. Most had lived in New Hampshire for a long period. About half the respondents were male and female, and like the demographics of the state, the vast majority were white, and most were employed full-time. So just broad results from the survey. Most of the people, 82%, who responded to our survey drink their tap water. That is the tap water coming from their wells, either always or frequently. About 80% of the respondents tested their water, not all necessarily for arsenic, but had recalled testing it at some point. The most common time since testing was the period between 3 and 10 years ago, so quite some time, certainly longer than most recommendations. And the strongest considerations as to why they were testing were they answered, and they could answer more than one here, but the most common answers were they wanted to know if the water was safe to drink or they had it tested as part of a real estate transaction. Three-quarters of the respondents understood the test results that they received. We were concerned as to whether or not people were understanding how they were, the results were reported, and it seemed people at least believed that they were understanding them correctly. But that also indicates that about a quarter didn't understand, and they followed up then typically with the state labs or the lab that performed their test. And about two-thirds understood what those results meant in terms of what actions they should take. In other words, about a third didn't understand exactly what they should be doing. So there's some opportunity there to help people understand how to act on their test results. Of the 20% who didn't test their water said that they meant to do it, almost half said they meant to do it but never quite got around to it, or they didn't know how to go about having it tested, or as we learned in our focus groups, because it looked or smelled or tasted clean, they didn't see that that was necessary. Or simply they hadn't had any health problems associated with drinking the water, and so they didn't see that there was any need to test. But those rates of testing were higher, were lower in the towns with higher arsenic. So about 40% of well owners in high arsenic towns had not tested their water for arsenic. I shouldn't say lower or higher. Actually, that was about typical. What I mean to point out here is that there's a significant number of people at potential risk, about 40%, who simply didn't know what the results were. About 67% of our respondents do treat their water, not necessarily for arsenic, although some do. Many of them have water softeners, which they consider to be treatment. Like our focus groups, many, 39%, had never tested their water since starting to use their water treatment system, and another 20% only tested it very rarely. So they really don't know if their treatment systems are effective at what they believe they should be doing. It turns out that about half who state that they treat their water because they want to remove arsenic, self-reported treatment systems that actually aren't effective at removing arsenic. And so there's some mismatch there between what people believe they're treating for and the kind of treatment systems they report that they have. Of those who don't treat their water, only about 46% have actually shown for themselves that they don't need to treat it. That is by having their water tested and finding that there was no concern. Okay, so what did we actually do with this information? Well, what we wanted to do next was use it to try to inform interventions that we would do in specific towns in order to see if we could promote testing and treatment. And so we chose towns to work with first and then designed some communication materials that we would use and then went about implementing these interventions and evaluating the success. So the goal here was primarily not necessarily to lead to the highest rates of testing and treatment possible, but to try a variety of things and see what would work and what didn't work to serve as a kind of model for statewide initiatives. So we focused on southeastern New Hampshire because that's where the concern was. We used a couple of criteria to decide what towns we would decide to work with. We looked at a few pre-readiness screening criteria, that is just simply looking which towns have higher arsenic concentrations and which ones had higher concentrations of people served by wells. Of those 16 towns we selected from that, we applied 10 additional screening criteria. That is whether there was an existing person who was serving as a kind of champion for that town or leader on the issue of arsenic in water, whether there's already some kind of ordinance or not regarding arsenic, essentially looking at the awareness of the town to this as a problem. And then we chose 8 towns to do in-depth community readiness interviews. We interviewed, actually Catherine Lawler, I should say, our community engagement coordinator, interviewed 22 individuals from those 8 towns to get a better sense of whether they were in a position to implement our intervention and to get an idea of whether the towns we selected would be comparable with respect to their readiness. So we finally selected 6 towns that we continued to work. Those 6 were Barrington, Bow, Londonderry, Wyndham, Pelham, and Epsom. And those are listed on the left side here. We decided to try out 3 different types of interventions, one being town communications. That's simply to use existing town communication channels, like billboards, listservs, mailings, to distribute messages to town residents. The other was to actually meet people in person at some community hotspots, like libraries or town halls or general stores, to discuss issues with them in person. The other was to have testing events where we distribute kits, sample kits, to residents at some central location, like the town dump or transfer station or library or town hall. And the idea was is that these 3 spanned a kind of spectrum from relatively low effort interventions, that is the town communications, to higher interventions where we needed face-to-face discussions, to the highest, most intensive ones where we actually distributed testing kits to see what degree of interventions were necessary in order to get good results, good responses. We used a kind of experimental design for this. That is, we decided with these 3 interventions for each one to be implemented 4 times and every combination of 2 to be implemented in duplicate. And so you can see from this table which towns had which interventions, and you see that they were implemented in pairs for each town such that we meet those requirements above. That allows us to get the most information we can out of our experimental design. So the next step was to develop the communication materials that we would use for our town communications and that we would use for the face-to-face intercept campaign. We held some focus groups. We worked with the Community Health Institute in New Hampshire, a public health communication organization who were terrific to work with. I'd highly recommend them to people. They have a vast experience in public health communication. And we focused on testing with our focus groups a few different visual themes to the materials and a few different message themes. The visual themes were just ways in which the material would look, whether it would have a kind of focus on infographics or look like a kind of professional public health material, whether it would focus more on a photojournalistic style or some kind of personal testimonial, and what kinds of themes they would emphasize. Emphasize perhaps just the aspects of exposure, how you get exposed and in what ways, what the health risks might be, what kinds of social norms there may or may not be around testing and treatment, or trying to identify and then overcome specific barriers that we identified in our survey. After the focus groups, we got additional input from experienced project advisory team that worked with us and a technical advisory team that were more involved in the project. So here's just a sampling of some of the visual themes I've just mentioned, and these are just some scores that came out of the focus groups. You can see that some of them are infographic-based, like on the bottom left. Some of them are a little bit more in-your-face, kind of concerning, with large lettering and bright colors. Some focus on aspects of children, for example. And just different ways of kind of getting people's attention with a visual. Then here are the different examples of some of the different messaging themes. I know you probably can't read these, but just to demonstrate that we took consistent elements like health risks or overcoming barriers and tested these with the focus groups to see what they responded to and in what ways. Here's what we finally came up with. It was actually a combination of a few of our visual and thematic elements. You can see we have 2 different versions of it. It uses some bright colors, but not something that's particularly scary. The red, white, and blue was intended to be somewhat patriotic. This was happening in summers, partly around 4th of July. It was something to catch people's attention. People liked the infographics in the focus groups. They were eye-catching. They gave information quickly and simply. But they also wanted some more detail, and so we had some bulleted points below. The fact that a person giving a testimonial was useful, and because people could relate to that, we found that in our survey that people liked personal testimonials. They were strongly influenced by whether they had talked to friends and neighbors, and that was reflected here. Also, the fact that we were seeing lower testing rates among minority populations was informed our choice of the person reflected here. And then we had our a website on the bottom where they could get some more information. And we actually did win an award for this through a public health organization who appreciated the layout and content of our materials here. This was a postcard that we also had available at the interventions and distributed through town communications in a slightly smaller format with much of the same material. So we implemented this in 6 towns. These are the details. I'm not going to go through these. You can get these maybe looking at the slides. But just to emphasize, there were a lot of events in a lot of different towns. Catherine organized and participated, led all of these. She was really running around all summer doing these. And some of them were inside, some were outside. They were half-day or day-long events. Most had 2 people present. In some cases, the more successful ones had community volunteers, those champions that we talked about earlier. And then you could see the types of locations where we held either the testing events or the intercept campaigns. Remember, in addition to the ones listed here, we had town communications. These are just the specific events that we had, the intercepts and the testing events that are color-coded here. All right, so overall, some numbers combined. These are combined numbers for each type of intervention. You can see that in testing events, we reached about 310 people versus intercept campaigns where we reached over 400. In town communications, we don't know exactly how many people we reached because there wasn't a good count of that. That just went out to people, and they may or may not looked at the postcard or seen the flyers, but we did this in 4 towns. The testing events led to 250 test kits that were requested as part of those events. The intercept campaigns had specific interactions with discussions with about 150 people, and about 13 test kits were requested as a result of those. And the town communications, we know, led to about 18 test kits. So the number of total test kit requests were 290. And of those, we only got 45 back, so not a huge return given how many we handed out. And for the variety of reasons we've already heard about today as to why people may not necessarily follow up. But nevertheless, this did lead to almost 100% increase relative to the previous year as a result of our intervention. And so it did double the number of kits in these small towns that were returned. All right, this is one of the key results coming from this. What combinations of interventions were effective? And you can see from the box plot or the diamond plot below that the middle one, the combination of town communications and testing events, led to the greatest increase in the number of tests relative to the previous year. And this worked. This meant that the testing events, when preceded by town communications, were effectively advertised. It seemed that the intercept campaign didn't reach enough people to sufficiently advertise the testing events, so that the one on the far right, intercept campaigns combined with the testing events, didn't increase testing above the combination of town communications and intercept campaign. Neither of these significantly increased the testing relative to the previous year. So what we've learned overall, some challenges were that we had a relatively short implementation period. We had to do all this quickly and in a tight time frame, given the constraints of the funding and of the project that we had for this particular effort. It was difficult to track the reach of the town communication intervention specifically, and so we really aren't able to evaluate the effectiveness of those very well. We tried to balance what the town wanted to do and what we needed to do for our project requirements, and sometimes that was a bit of a tough call. The town sometimes wanted to do things that didn't always conform with our experimental design, and sometimes we wanted to do some things that the town wasn't ready for or didn't feel were most appropriate, and so we needed to have some good communication and compromise. The town partners, like all of us, are busy, and so we couldn't take their time for granted. We needed to use that effectively. And so it was sometimes hard to get their engagement and get volunteers to come out. And overall, we saw low test kit returns, which was a little bit disappointing. The strengths were that, indeed, we did lead to higher rates of testing than the previous year, and there were some other side effects, like effective education of people. And having community partners and engagement were really a key to our success. The towns that where we had that were more effective than the towns that weren't. And overall, the professional communication materials, I think, were an asset. They were eye-catching and informative. And so one thing we took from this is that having a reusable community toolkit that makes use of the professionally developed materials and the lessons learned was an important outcome of our project. And so just wrapping up here, we did produce a pamphlet that was this community toolkit. It had some of the same visual elements and thematic elements as our communication materials. You can see the cover of it here. And just here's the table of content. Basically, what the toolkit provides is a way for community organizers to have a kind of roadmap for what they should do based on what we've learned. It starts with a flow chart as to where they should start in the process, depending on where they are in the readiness cycle, and then developing a plan that works for them, and then providing some resources that they can use to help them in that process. Here's this flow chart that I mentioned. You can see that they start at the top left and answer some questions that help them to jump in at various steps in the process, depending on what they've already accomplished and where they are in the process. And that directs them to specific sections of the toolkit, which provide resources then in the form of some postcards, some announcement or flyer sheets, and links to state resources, websites, and phone resources. And we also provide them with some tables that can help them in their planning to help identify their target audience and their time frame and the number of volunteers, and then be able to share that with other organizations. So our reports that go into all this whole project in more detail are available at the website, our website at the URL listed. Catherine Lawler is who you should contact for additional thoughts or questions. She's our community engagement coordinator of our Superfund program. As was mentioned, I'll be leaving Dartmouth in the next month to start a position at Duke. We have a replacement community engagement project leader. But for now, Catherine should be the person you should talk to. This project was supported by the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services by a grant through the CDC. And, of course, our Superfund program is funded by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. And our work with them is quite complementary to the work we are doing with NHDES and CDC in the course of this particular project. So thanks for your attention. And if we have a couple minutes for questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Mark. We have just a few, just one or two that we can take, and then the rest of them we'll have to send to you because we're running a minute short on time. I have a question about how was the QA/QC maintained to ensure there was no interference and incorrect results, given you just handed these out to the homeowners?
I didn't have time to go into, we actually weren't doing any water testing ourselves. We were just promoting water testing, which was then undertaken largely from the state labs, but there may have been some private labs as well. And so the QA/QC of the test results was handled by the corresponding lab, not by us.
Okay. Of the 290 kits distributed, that included the 253 given out during the testing event, right?
That's correct. So the vast majority went out from the testing event.
Okay. And when you were since your population was 96% white, I know you said that you were trying to focus on that percentage that was low income, or you didn't get any response back, but still you had such a high white population, so you went with a black model anyway.
Right. Well, it wasn't necessarily a matter of income. I mean, the racial aspect that we detected. It wasn't a socioeconomic or economic component. But we did anyway. We felt like we wanted to inform some of our work by what we did find from our survey, and so that was helping to inform us on that. Other elements of selecting, not to overthink it too much, but other elements of selecting the model were a young person to. We were trying to reach out to new families, and so the model we selected was relatively young in appearance. And so because it was also younger families with kids that were not answering or not testing in large numbers, and so we wanted to make sure to get younger people's attention.
Okay. That's going to end our time for the questions. Like I said, the rest we will send to you. So we are going to move on to Nisha Graves' presentation.
Hello.
And Nisha is from UNC SRP, the Superfund Research Program Center, and she has a community partner with her, Caroline Armijo. I hope I'm saying that right. What was that?
I just said Armijo is how you
say it. Armijo, okay. Nisha is with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill at the Environmental Resource Program. She's an environmental health educator. She coordinates outreach on environmental health and environmentally related diseases for various offices throughout the state. She serves on the Board of Environmental Education Fund and is as the chair of the Environmental Committee for the Asthma Alliance of North Carolina. Prior to joining the Environmental Resource Program, she was a public health program consultant for NC Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program with the North Carolina Department of Environmental and Natural Resources. She also worked with the North Carolina Office of Environmental Education and as a high school social studies teacher. Ms. Graves earned an MPA from North Carolina Central University and a BA in history from Meredith College. She will be presenting with Ms. Armijo and a community partner with the Residents for Coal Ash Cleanup Organization. Thank you, Nisha.
Thank you. We're excited to present Well Empowered, a joint endeavor between the North Carolina Center for Environmental Risk Analysis and the community partner Residents for Coal Ash Cleanup in Belews Creek, North Carolina. NCSERA is also known as the UNC Chapel Hill Superfund Research Program under its current funding, and it reflects emerging research efforts around environmental risk analysis submitted in our proposal last spring to NICHS. And as you heard earlier, my presentation partner is Caroline Armijo. This is an outline of the project that Caroline and I are going to discuss. We're really introducing the work and the goals of our programs and how we came to work together on the issue of determining whether there are toxic metals in well water in Belews Creek around coal ash ponds and whether this research can benefit communities in North Carolina as they seek ways to reduce or to eliminate their exposure to toxic metals in North Carolina, in private well water in North Carolina. This slide highlights that NCSERA has an interdisciplinary team of researchers that are seeking to develop new risk analysis framework that incorporates information from the varied sciences that are represented, as you see in this slide. You may have seen a similar picture from Dr. Fry earlier. The themes around this work are epigenetics and real-world mixtures. On this slide, you'll see that we highlight having biomedical projects and environmental science projects. And in the biomedical projects, researchers are focused on understanding the influences of toxic metals and PCBs on disease risk, particularly understanding diabetes, preeclampsia, and melanoma. On the other side of the slide, the environmental science project involved research on treating PAH-contaminated soil and using passive sampling devices to measure contaminants in water and soil. Another aim of NCSERA is to train the next generation of interdisciplinary scientists in improved risk analysis. On this next slide, you'll see it highlights the work of research translation and community engagement teams in NCSERA, particularly as we work to bridge the gap between research and community. One aim is to translate the science of the center with key stakeholders. As you see, Dr. Fry on the left side of this slide, presenting information on health impacts of toxic metals to a board of county commissioners in eastern North Carolina. The other aim involves engaging vulnerable communities, as you see on the right-hand side, with one of our center's trainees discussing toxic metals in well water with a North Carolina resident at a local science event. In addition to facilitating bidirectional communication between researchers and community, our community engagement team is seeking to build the capacity of stakeholders to document toxic metal exposures in their communities and to develop responses that that reduce or eliminate harmful exposure. Next, I'll turn it over to Caroline, who will really get to the heart of the community that we're working with.
Thank you, Nisha. Coal-burning power production is still a major source of power in North Carolina. Duke Energy has a monopoly here. There are 14 Duke sites and 7 currently operating plants. The third largest coal ash spill in U.S. history, known as the Dan River Spill, happened on Groundhog Day 2014 in Eden in Rockingham near the North Carolina-Virginia state line. This is what you see here on the screen. The large metal pipe on the left corroded and failed, causing the spill. It took Duke a week to plug this pipe. The community we're discussing today is located at a second plant 30 miles upstream on the Dan River called the Blues Creek Steam Station. Okay, ready for the next slide? Nisha, are you changing that? Okay.
I did.
This is the Blues Creek Steam Station located in Stokes County. The map in the lower right shows the proximity to the Dan River plant, and it also shows that we're about 45 minutes north of Winston-Salem and Greensboro. It was built in 1974, and it's one of the largest power plants in the Carolinas. It provides a fifth of the state's power. There's over 20 million tons of coal ash located at Blues. We have specifically been advocating for the cleanup of the main coal ash pond, which you see here in the foreground. It holds 12 million tons of ash and 14 billion gallons of water. It's a 280 acres large, and it's over 14 stories deep. In the lower left corner stands a 40-year, 140-foot dam, and that dam is classified as high risk for failure. And so this would make the Eden spill look pale in comparison. There are 27 drains located on the dam that have been discharging water continuously into the Dan River since 2006. Duke also discharges directly into West Blues Creek and Blues Lake, which is a recreational lake, seen throughout the picture behind the plant. The Dan River provides over 7 downstream municipalities drinking water and serves a combined population of 360,000. Stokes County is a rural county of around 47,000 people. The impacted area I'll discuss today includes 3 communities, creating a triangle around the Blues Creek power plant, which you see on the map. That's Wanaco, Pine Hall, and Blues Creek. The overall population is politically conservative and not necessarily in favor of regulation. Also, Duke is the county's largest income source of 13% of the county's budget. Everyone in the county lives on well water, including Walnut Cove, which has a municipal water system that is sourced from 3 local wells. These wells have had their own set of issues over the years. These impacted communities have a substantial African American population in comparison to the rest of the county, which only equals 4%. Yet in Walnut Cove, it's closer to 19%. Plus, there are a couple of African American communities just outside of the town boundaries that bear the brunt of the environmental hazards of coal ash and the threat of fracking. In 2010, my friend was diagnosed with a brain tumor at the age of 34. I didn't know anything about coal ash at the time when I first asked what's in the water, but I was wary of how many people had cancer and were dying. I began reaching out to other community members, and we began to document names of people who had been sick or passed away. Annie Brown, one of our leaders who passed in 2014, created basically an informal health survey. I also reached out to Dennis Limley, a professor at Wake Forest University who studied the wildlife at Blue Lake for over 20 years. He discovered that 19 of the 20 local fish species became locally extinct during the 80s due to the selenium. I wanted to let him know that not only the fish were dying, but our people were too. In October 2012, my cousin was also diagnosed with a brain tumor. Dr. Abner Van Gosch published a paper on increased toxicity of coal ash with the new air scrubbers. He put me in touch with Earth Justice, who put me in touch with Appalachian Voices, who's our lead organizing group. The community organization in Blue Creek was established in early 2013, over a year before the Dan River spill in 2014. We had a great turnout initially, but the spill really galvanized our efforts because suddenly everybody knew what coal ash was and it became national news overnight. To help build a network with other groups in the state with the same interest, we began having statewide meetings and calls with all of the 14 sites plus two locations that are receiving ash and disposal landfills according to Duke's cleanup agreement. This group is known as Act Against Coal Ash. From the community meetings in Blues, we've learned that there's been a long-time mistrust of water quality and community awareness of environmental health concerns around Blues Creek. Despite these people not having a large income, many residents have been purchasing bottled water for several years before the state issued Do Not Drink letters last spring, which led to Duke providing bottled water to over 400 families across the state. Dr. Van Gosch's recent publication on toxic metals existing in the leaking ponds confirms those recent concerns. Our additional concerns include recent legislation known as HB 630 that would allow for the seven of the coal ash pond sites to be clapped in place. This includes Blues, and that means that our water table would be permanently polluted with no chance of excavation. Another concern for the area is part of the land adjacent to the coal ash pond is being considered for potential fracking. In September 2015, Andrew George, a member of the community engagement team, was present at one of our statewide press conferences in Raleigh. Upon learning about the UNC's team's research, one of our community members invited the team to visit Blues Creek. Realizing that arsenic was being studied at UNC, and that is a major toxin showing up in the groundwater, specifically at Blues, we saw opportunities to engage with Dr. Rebecca Fry. We invited her and the community engagement team to meetings of the community organization and a tour of the affected area. Dr. Fry has presented research on health implications from exposures to toxic metals through well water to our residents. In April, she presented this information to an advisory committee of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, only one of two held in the country. We pursued this partnership with UNC because we need data. We have all of these community stories, and we wanted trusted, objective data that informs us about the toxic metals, particularly whether those metals are in our water, and practical advice on how to stop the exposure and prevent illnesses.
Thank you, Caroline. Next, I'll talk about the project we're pursuing with the community in Blues Creek. From the beginning of this project, we sought to incorporate community input in the development of research questions and the consideration of data that would be most useful for the community in identifying toxic metals and the ways that exposure could be reduced or eliminated. So there are two phases, as you see on this slide, both in Stokes County, where Blues Creek is, with adults who get their drinking water from private wells. The community engagement team is conducting phase one, primarily to understand how people use their well water, their concerns about their well water, and how any knowledge they have about local environmental health issues might affect their use of well water. And then phase two, is the biomonitoring phase that will be conducted by the Environmental Health Sciences team to understand if there are toxic metals present and the practical advice that Caroline talked about earlier so that they are seeking to reduce or stop exposure. So Drs. Fry and Vengosh are the lead researchers in Phase 2. Both phases are currently under review from UNC Chapel Hill's Institutional Review Board, and we expect to begin the study any day now. We anticipate this project pilot being the model for Wayne County in eastern North Carolina. As this project seeks to categorize the extent of toxic metals contamination in Belews Creek, we note that this is the first time a community in North Carolina is actively shaping research on toxic metals and well water. As we take well, soil, and biological samples to analyze the potential connections, we anticipate that this will better help us to understand environmental exposure so that the center can share the data with the community and give sound advice the community is seeking. Just to wrap up, NC Sarah welcomes the opportunity to collaborate with the folk in Belews Creek on this study of toxic metals and potential exposures. I hope Caroline and I have shown you a snapshot of Belews Creek, the community itself, and the work that the center and community residents are about to pursue in understanding those potential exposures and how the community can respond to them. Thanks a lot for joining us today, and feel free to contact Caroline or myself with any additional questions beyond our Q&A session today.
Thank you, Nisha. Are there any questions? I haven't seen any come in on the Q&A, so if anybody wants to ask on the phone, you can hit your star six to open the line and then close it with the pound six once you're done. So let's see here. Here we go. In your brochures, was there a long-term arsenic intake effect on the I'm sorry, that was the previous one. We've got a note for thank you for the presentation. It was really nice. Like I said, I don't see any other questions.
Okay.
And so let's go ahead and move on, and we'll allow Janet to start with his presentation. Dr. Janik Artolia is with the University of Arizona SRP Center, and he is an associate professor with an Extension Water Quality Specialist and the SRP Research Translation Corps co-principal investigator at the university. As part of his Extension appointment, Janik has co-authored more than 15 Extension publications, including two booklets on water and private wells. He has also presented more than 33-hour workshops covering Arizona's geology, water resources, regulations, well maintenance, and well water treatment options for the private well owners in the last 8 years. Doctor, please.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to present our efforts and to work with communities and government agencies that address this issue of arsenic in drinking water and well testing in Arizona. Our partners include the Arizona Department of Health Services and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. So a brief overview of arsenic in Arizona and its population. Arizona has a diverse geology. It's divided into three zones, the plateau, the basin range, and the transition zones. It gives us a mixture of very deep sand and gravel aquifers, as well as hard rock and sedimentary rock aquifers. Because of the past volcanic activities, it left veins very rich in copper, lead, zinc, and gold, and unfortunately arsenic with it. You may know that Arizona produces about 64% or more than 50% of the copper in the U.S. Arizona has about 130,000 private wells, and they serve about 7% or so of the Arizona's 6.5 million population. These well owners are usually in rural environments, and they are an isolated population that's hard to reach and serve. It tends to be distrustful of agencies, and that is usually, again, makes it difficult to reach them. In a recent survey, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality surveyed 1,500 irrigation and production wells, not private wells, and they showed elevated levels of arsenic about in the 20% range, which seems to be about twice the national average. See the map attached on the right with the circles and the various levels of arsenic contamination. I should say that similar high rates or higher rates of arsenic exceedances have been shown in surveys of private wells. We're in fact now collecting all the surveys and putting them in a more formal report. But the exceedances are usually above 20%. Communicating risk to the Dewey Homo community through the SRP Garden Roots and Metals Exposure Home Study. We identified elevated levels of arsenic in the public and private wells in the community of Dewey Humboldt in northern Arizona, about just the middle of the center of Arizona, in the transitional zone. There's a lot of mineral-rich activity there, mining. The risk communication was complicated by the presence of both a Superfund site, where we're doing work there, and also naturally occurring levels of arsenic in groundwater that are not linked to the Superfund site. They're just naturally occurring. So the UASRP, in partnership with four agencies and the U of A Extension, informed the community through a multi-stakeholder community meeting that was very successful about the connection between exposure to arsenic, including the health effects, and who can be affected, and how to best limit exposure. This resulted in a UASRP two-page handout for the community titled Arsenic in Drinking Water and What You Need to Know. That communicates essentially what levels of arsenic pose a threat and what can be done to treat your water. You see the example of it. The copy of it is on the right side. On to my well owner workshops. Basically, those are given through the University Extension County Centers, distributed throughout 14 of our counties. We give about 3 to 5 a year, and I've been giving those workshops since 2008. My co-presenters are Christine Allman and Gary Hicks. They are basically hydrologists and geologists and private well and a retired well owner that complement my knowledge of chemistry and help really round up those workshops. They are comprehensive, 3 hours, and the topics that are covered are basically listed down here. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but we emphasize a lot the issue of naturally occurring contaminants, particularly things like arsenic, gross alpha radiation, which are also a big issue here, radon, nitrates. And we also emphasize a lot the issue of testing, when and where to sample. And we spend a fair amount of time discussing water treatment options. And so those are very well-attended seminars and usually run over time with the questions that we get. The workshops are, again, sponsored through the U of A Cooperative Extension, but presently we have also funding from the Arizona Department of Health Services. It's providing up to 3 years of funding in support of these workshops and other tasks, including collecting a more comprehensive database on private well owners' water quality, as well as updating the well owners' book that I'll mention next. Materials have also been produced with funding from UASRP, the Water Resources Research Center, and other programs, including Extension. And finally, very briefly, those are the materials that we have produced through this last 10 years through Extension primarily, and those are Extension publications. They're available also through the University of Arizona SRP website. And a very popular booklet is Arizona Know Your Water. In its third printing, 15,000 copies, an unknown number of downloads as PDF files, It's also in the Spanish version. And the very popular Arizona Well Owner's Guide that is distributed in our workshops, 76 page and 6,000 copies distributed, and it's now presently under revision. We also have recently finished a 10-page publication on how to lower levels of arsenic in well water. It's an SRP extension publication, and it talks about things, more specific things, about things like RO and iron filters as options to treat arsenic. We have many other publications that I'm not going to mention, including the ones that I mentioned before that came from the community engagement, as well as videos and several other publications that can be downloaded through the University of Arizona Extension Publications website, as well, and the Superfund website at the University of Arizona. And with that, I thank you and for your attention, and I'll open it up for questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Dr. Artola? How great or how little is the impact of arsenic in soil and the total risk of those exposed to arsenic in water?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
I'm not sure if this one's supposedly directed to you, but it says how great or little is the impact of arsenic in soil to the risk of those exposed to arsenic in water?
Okay, there is. Usually when you see elevated levels of arsenic in soils, they're usually tied to elevated levels of arsenic in the mineral geology around. That's pretty normal. Whether it's related or not to the water itself below the surface, it's hard to tell because we have a very complex geological distribution of arsenic. It could be a sedimentary, depositional, and consolidated material with multiple layers of some of them being rich, some of them not in arsenic, or it could be rock, aquifers overlying, very shallow, depositional soil. So it's very difficult to tell whether there's a direct relationship always between soil at the surface soil and groundwater arsenic.
Thank you. Have you seen an increase in the private testing?
We are beginning to collect data on that. We don't have a lot of data on that information. We don't do enough follow-ups. That's some things that we're working on. And so there is a bit of a decoupling on that. But that has to do with the fact that this is a difficult population. They, believe it or not, oftentimes don't have the communications that we take for granted, such as access to the Internet, even though it's getting a lot better now. But one of the things that I do for them in my seminars is actually give them either CDs or keys, now USB keys with our publications, so as to eliminate the need for them to download them or access the websites, because sometimes it's an issue in rural environments.
Thank you. How does your booklet describe lowering arsenic in the well water?
I missed that word.
How does the booklet describe lowering arsenic in the well water?
Okay, so booklet itself, the last publication we used primarily reverse osmosis as the method of choice. Arizona has primarily arsenic 5 in water, even though, again, the data is spotty, but our aquifers are fairly well aerated, so arsenic 5 tends to dominate. It's easy to remove or easier to remove with RO. We also discuss now the use of iron filters. As mentioned before, they work for both 3 and 5, but they are a problem, even though they're easy to install because we don't have a lot of vendors, and then the other issue is that you have to do testing, and you have to know their loads, and there's a lot of issues with the chemistry of the water that make them render them inefficient, such as high levels of silica and salts and other salts that can render them pretty efficient. So pre-testing is an issue. We don't recommend them, but we talk about them and discuss the pros and cons of those filters.
Okay. Do your workshops include participation by the local environmental health or professionals?
They are now, yes.
How many people do you normally get attending the workshop?
Workshops can be anywhere from 1,000 to 60 or 70 or even 100.
Okay. And is arsenic from pesticides a concern?
Not at all. Arsenic, even though arsenic has been used extensively in our agricultural environments as defoliants, arsenic doesn't tend to move very easily through our soils. They're very calcareous. They have a lot of free calcium and a lot of iron that basically pretty much stops the arsenic from really transferring down to the aquifers, as far as we know. Our aquifers are also very deep. You know, we call a shallow aquifer a 50-foot aquifer. Sure, that's not the case in the East Coast. And so, you know, we're not aware of any arsenic contamination coming from agricultural activities.
Okay. It does not appear that there are many wells in the northeastern portion of the state. Is there some reason for that?
Yeah,
that
those
wells
are
tested.
First Nation land, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality does not collect, at least does not report information from the First Nation. The Apache Nation has, Navajo Nation, I'm sorry, has its own ADQ, Department of Environmental Quality, and they collect their own data now. During that study, if they collected data, they did not report it in this study.
Okay. You mentioned the issues of separating natural resources, the natural sources of arsenic and Superfund sources. Can you explain a bit about, in your talk, about the difference of the risk exposure for those?
Well, in that particular Superfund site, EPA did, who's monitoring that, the water quality, and did studies. Basically, they did not identify arsenic as coming from the Superfund site, from the mine tailings there, it's the mine site. They could not find a link. They did find a link with sulfates, elevated levels of sulfates downstream from the site, but the arsenic, again, due to the immobility of arsenic in general through our soils and vato zone, and particularly in iron-rich and calcium-rich environments, arsenic doesn't tend to transport very easily. So there was no connection in that particular Superfund site between the residual levels, the high levels of arsenic that are found in mine tailings and groundwater arsenic, which is pretty much deemed to be naturally occurring in that area.
Okay. Dr. Fry suggests that the RO is not the best treatment for removing arsenic, but your experience has been different?
Arsenic 3,
right.
Arsenic 5 seems to work just fine. You can lower the levels, but arsenic 3 is a problem, and we don't have a lot of arsenic 3 in our groundwater, as indicated, because of the nature of our aquifers. So our aquifers are usually very low in organic matter. Reducing conditions are not very common. Once the arsenic is dissolved, arsenic 3, they become arsenic 5 pretty quickly. So we don't see that as an issue yet. Again, but we are discussing alternative methods such as iron filters. Again, they're problematic to maintain and install and maintain and monitor.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go back to one quick question. I think this is for Ms. Graves. We have a question. Have you collected hexavalent chrome concentrations or considered it related to the coal ash?
I think I'm going to turn that over to Dr. Fry. Hello? Dr. Fry, are you still on the call?
Dr. Fry, if you are still on, we can't hear you, so please make sure to unmute your line by pressing #6.
I know that that
Well, we can get back to on that question, but I think this was a consideration that I was going to ask, any of the presenters if they've been looking at, hexavalent chrome along with the arsenic that would be related to possibly pesticides or other like Superfund type contaminants.
No, I have not. No, we have not.
And I believe that's a consideration, but I would prefer for Dr. Fry to be the one to elaborate on that.
Can any of the
hello? This is. Can you hear me? This is Kathleen Gray.
Yes.
Hello.
Sure.
This is
yes.
Kathleen Gray with the UNC Superfund Research Program. I work with Nisha. So we are going to be testing for a panel of metals, arsenic, total chromium. I believe we are also looking at hexavalent because I believe Dr. Van Gosch is capable of doing that. But we will get back with you, the moderator, and confirm that so you can share that information with the person asking the question. But we're going to be doing a panel of inorganics as well as some other contaminants. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to do this one last question. To ask any of the speakers if they are looking at the arsenic from pesticides as part of their study, if we've had a couple of people ask about that. Okay, well, at that, we're going to get ready to conclude the session. Before we conclude, I want to make sure everyone is aware of the related URL pod, which contains the seminar resources and the seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources, we will be assembling those resources, and that will include some of the all the material that's sort of been referenced here, so that you'll have links to it. And so there will be a lot of information on that. Please go back and check it. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We will, let you know when we try to get all that material up, but we're still putting it on there. But it should be up soon. We will place these seminars in archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will also be able to access the slides and hear the presentation over again as it was given today. Also related URLs pod, you will find the online seminar feedback form. We're asking that you consider filling out the feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try and improve the content and the delivery mechanisms of these webinars. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I would like to remind the participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on the EPA's CLUIN webinars, refer to the CLUIN.org webpage, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page. You can follow us on the EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter as well. So we really appreciate everyone being on the webinar, and at that, we're going to close it out. Thank you.